I always prided myself on my resilience and toughness as an athlete. I definitely did not give my brain injuries the same respect as the injuries I could see, and I continue to pay the ultimate price.
Welcome to Sport Intelligence, the Canadian Perspective, brought to you by the Sport Information Resource Center, or CIRC. I'm your host, Paula Baker, and today's episode is a special one. Consider it a little amuse-bouche between seasons, served up in advance of Concussion Awareness Week. From September 21 to 27, CIRC is leading the charge for sports organizations to talk about concussions, and we want you to join the conversation. From new resources to plug-and-play social media templates, we've got you covered. This episode is just the beginning, so be sure to follow CIRC and visit our website to learn more. So did you know every year concussions affect thousands of athletes across the country, with recent estimates suggesting that over 200,000 concussions happen every year in Canadian sports alone? And while the physical impacts of these injuries often take center stage, the psychological effects can be just as significant, especially when it comes to returning to sport. Mental readiness, emotional resilience, and even fear of re-injury all play a role in how and when athletes get back in the game. The good news? Concussion research has come a long way, but when it comes to understanding the full psychological toll of these injuries and how best to support athletes, we still have work to do. To help us unpack the latest concussion research and best practices with where we still need to go, we'll be speaking with Dr. Keith Yates today. Keith is a professor in the Department of Psychology and adjunct professor of pediatrics and clinical neurosciences at the University of Calgary. With more than three decades in brain research, he's considered a global leader in concussion research, having led major studies, contributed to international consensus statements, and spearheaded knowledge-sharing initiatives like the Canadian Concussion Network. Keith, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Paula. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. Now, as mentioned, you've been a leader in brain injury research and have contributed so much to the advancement of concussion research. In that time, what would you say are some of the key recommendations or practices that have changed when it comes to concussion, and how has that changed how we support athletes who have sustained a concussion?
Yeah, a lot's changed in the last 30 years. One of the biggest ones was the field's advance in terms of the recognition that rest until better is not the best strategy. We've really come a long way, moved away from the old cocoon notion, staying in a dark room until you weren't having symptoms, to a really much more active and hopeful approach to management that tells people that they are likely to recover, that we can get them active within a day or two of their injury, begin to get them back to school or back to work, back to sport. I think that's just made a sort of a massive change, because it wasn't just about the rest, but it led us to realize we really need to do the research in terms of trials to find out what works. We, for too long, probably based our management of concussion on expert opinion. And while that's valuable, it's not nearly as valuable as good data. And as we've begun to get data, we've begun to realize that we can have a positive effect on concussion in many ways that we might not have suspected. And the revolution of rest until is best is gone away. And now we're, I think, really moving forward.
So why is it such an important topic for the sports sector to be talking about concussion and to stay up to date on?
Concussion affects a lot of athletes. My work is in kids and adolescents, and whether it's organized sport or just everyday recreation, really high rates of concussion, lifetime incidence of at least 1 in 10. And then, of course, when you start talking about college or university athletes or elite athletes and young adults, the numbers get even higher. North America, probably at least 2 million a year sport-related Wow. concussions. So with those sorts of numbers, it's a lot of for coaches and sport medicine physicians and other professionals involved in the care of athletes to know what's happening. The sport field, in some ways, has really driven the advances in what we know about concussion, because, of course, they've been highly publicized in the sport area. It's really incumbent on everyone who's involved in sport to try to stay up to date as much as they can on what we know now based on better data than what we knew 10 or 20 years ago.
I guess you're right there. I was thinking of that because you don't often see the stories of someone bumping their head or getting hit in the head with something that's fallen in their garage, right? It's usually the athlete that's come forward with regards to the potentially life-altering consequences of having a concussion. So,
and you know, one of the things we're increasingly recognizing, it may not be as central in the sport area, is just how many different ways people get these injuries now, and high incidence populations we haven't been paying a lot of attention to, like victims of intimate partner violence, the unhoused or homeless community, infants and young children, older adults, where falls become the predominant mechanism of injury, both ends of the spectrum in terms of age. So we're starting to see it happens a lot in sport and recreation, but it happens a lot outside of sport and recreation. And yet a lot of what we learn about managing a concussion in sport may be applicable in some ways to those other groups as well.
Keith, I'm going to shift gears a little bit into more of the sweet spot of your recent research. So you and I discussed beforehand that in the past, there's been a big focus on the biological side of concussion, and yet your research is really showcasing the importance of also considering the psychological side of concussion and recovery. So how and when athletes feel mentally able to get back to sport, can you speak a bit to the psychological response athletes may have after a concussion and what your research has found?
On the psychological side for athletes, that sense of preparedness to return back to sport, even when they've been apparently recovered in terms of their symptoms and other things, is really still very important. Because if you have athletes that are fearful of being re-injured, of whether or not they've really recovered, are they at risk for other consequences of concussion that aren't apparent yet? The publicity about chronic traumatic encephalopathy has led a lot of athletes to be very concerned about longer-term consequences of concussion. So if you don't deal with that psychological preparedness, you really are missing the boat a bit in terms of clinical management. Because you can clear an athlete in terms of whether they're still symptomatic, whether they have any other indications or risk, but you may still be dealing with an athlete who really psychologically isn't ready to go back. Jeff Guerin at the University of Montreal has done some very nice work talking to athletes about what are their concerns before they go back to play. In my own work, we've been interested in how different psychological factors might determine how quickly athletes get back to sport. Things like fear avoidance. So are they really worried about getting a headache so they don't do anything and then they don't have the activity and the exercise that we know promotes recovery? Are they, on the other hand, the all or nothing type athlete who tries to push through their symptoms and then crashes and then tries again? Interestingly, those two things you'd think would be on opposite ends of the spectrum, but one and the same person who has high degrees of fear avoidance may also have high degrees of all or nothing behavior. They aren't mutually exclusive. We're still trying to figure out how you can hold both of those.
I would think they were completely opposite.
Nope, they aren't opposite ends of the spectrum as we might have suspected. This is why data really matters. And what we're finding, like when I did a project recently with an undergraduate student where we looked at sex differences and how males and females respond to injury. And interestingly, in this group of adolescent student athletes, it was really quite striking how females reported higher fear avoidance, higher all or nothing behavior, expectations that recovery would take longer, and lower psychological resilience. And all of those together help account for why time to recovery is longer for female athletes than it is for male athletes in this particular population. And that's even when we take into account how severe their symptoms were, how long it took them to get medical care, age, and other factors that we know also account for time to recovery. And the effects are pretty striking and pretty large. So psychological factors, even when you take into account the biology, play a really important role.
Did you guys discover as to why females feel that much more?
No, because we don't have enough. We need more data, right? You can't do everything in one project. So the natural next question is, why do they have these psychological differences? I mean, some of them, the expectation, for example, of longer recovery is actually not off the mark, because there's lots of data to suggest that adolescent females take longer to be cleared for sport, to be asymptomatic compared to male adolescent athletes. So it's not inaccurate necessarily, that expectation, but it might drive even longer recovery. So the question then becomes, like, why, and there's a lot of interest in the field right now in why females and males seem to have different recovery trajectories. Mm-hmm. There are biological factors that could be at play. hormonal differences, for example, among adolescents. Neck strength has been postulated as a possibility. Vulnerability of the brain. We know that males and females have different biomechanics involved in their injuries at times. So there are biological reasons, but there are these psychological reasons. And if women are more fear avoidant, more likely to engage in this sort of all or nothing, come into their injuries or right after their injuries have lower psychological resilience, those too could account for things. So that's the next natural next step. And then they become targets for intervention.
See, now I would have just thought because females seem to develop brains a little bit faster. That's why.
That's actually one of the things that's been hypothesized is that it has to do with that offset. If you look at pubertal status and pubertal, you know, progression through puberty, girls get there faster.
Yeah.
Does that have something to do with it? We know the adolescent brain is going through a tremendous period of development. There have been hypotheses about differential vulnerability by sex because those trajectories differ.
You know, you mentioned the girls were higher. Did the males skew in any particular direction with regards to fear?
They tended to report less fear avoidance, less all or nothing behavior. And that part surprised us. We had hypothesized males would be more likely to be tough and think they had to work through it, but it isn't what was reported. They tended to report more psychological resilience, and they tended to report expectation of a faster recovery. You know, it's interesting to think about whether it's the girls are overestimating the problem, are boys overestimating their resilience because they've been taught that they should be able to get back as quickly. So it's not clear that, and we don't want to by any means argue that females are doing the wrong thing in their psychological response. It's just that it's different. It seems to predict how quickly they're cleared to return to sport medically. And then the question becomes like, what's driving that? Maybe it'd be better if boys took longer too, but they underreport their symptoms and go back to place faster. So we don't want to make assumptions that because there are differences, it's just trying to understand what's happening.
Well, and it's interesting to see if they're falling into like gender stereotypes, like you said. So based on your research, do you have any suggestions on how individuals like coaches, parents, trainers can support athletes, particularly when it comes to their psychological readiness and like returning to sport after injury?
We've certainly learned that education is really important. And the first trick is just getting athletes to be willing to report their symptoms and report when they've had even a suspected concussion, because there's just now really very strong evidence from multiple studies in the US and Canada and other places around the world that the quicker you get somebody into care after a concussion, the faster their recovery. And that seems to be because if we can get them early, we can start the reentry process in a controlled way quickly, stop them from being re-injured. Arguably the biggest advance in the protocols of return to sport is it's prevented second concussions. The vast majority used to occur in the first week or two. And just by slowing down the return to sport, we've done a great job in preventing secondary concussion. But I don't want to make it sound like the only thing we worry about is what happens after concussion.
Right.
We also really want to try to stop them from happening in the first place. And then if an athlete has a concussion, just making sure they follow the protocols and acknowledging to the athletes that concussion can be kind of scary. Sometimes athletes really develop a lot of worry about how they're going to do, how they're going to recover, what's going to happen to me, and encouraging their athletes to share those concerns because they can be addressed. We sometimes, I think, forget that the data suggests that most people, at least symptomatically, recover pretty quickly for a concussion. But quickly is relative. I mean, we're talking 2 to 4 weeks.
Right.
So letting folks know what that course is even, setting realistic expectations about recovery so they don't start to get anxious. I'm already 3 weeks out from my concussion. I'm not all better. Well, that's typical. So it's a lot about education, expectations, and then support for the ones who do seem to take a bit longer and being sure that they get appropriate care as well.
You're listening to Sport Intelligence, The Canadian Perspective, where we're joined by Dr. Keith Yates, a professor at the University of Calgary and an expert in all things concussion. Keith is sharing his research and key advances when it comes to concussions in sport and what this means for supporting athletes so that they are physically and mentally ready to return to sport after their injury. But before we get back to Keith, I wanted to let you know the voice you heard at the beginning of the podcast was Jen Kish. For those of you who don't know about Jen, she's an Olympic bronze medalist, former captain of Canada's women's rugby sevens team, and one of the sport's most fearless players. She's had 30 concussions throughout her athletic career, and due to the accumulative effects of these injuries, she's been left with lingering issues to this day. Jen announced her retirement in April 2018, and a month later, she was part of a group of four high-performance female athletes to publicly pledge their brains to Toronto Western Hospital's Canadian Concussion Center to further research the effect of trauma on women's brains. Let's take a moment to hear what Jen said when she was the keynote speaker at the 2024 Concussion in Sport Symposium.
I was diagnosed with five major concussions that, like, I know about. But there were many more that went undiagnosed. And I believe the number is probably around 30 plus. And that's a lot. That is a lot. And the impact of these concussions on my physical and mental well-being has been extensive and continues to affect me to this day. However, it's the undiagnosed concussions that trouble me. Throughout my career, there were countless instances where I experienced blows to the head that left me disoriented and confused. And yet I never sought medical attention or reported these incidents. And the cumulative effects of these concussions have left me with lingering issues to this very day. And so I played through a lot, and it's definitely had a profound effect on my life after retirement. Listen to your body and your mind, and remember that your brain health should always be a top priority, because I can tell you right now, there is no amount of accolades or Olympic medals that ends up being worth your brain health. And I have to say, I never in a million years would have ever thought that statement would come out of my mouth, because I have always had the mindset of, I don't care what my retired life looks like. As long as I achieve my dream, going to the Olympics and trying to be the best in the world. I was wrong, naive, and short-sighted.
Wow, I absolutely appreciate how candid Jen is regarding her experience with concussion and the toll it's taken on her, as well as what she would do differently. All right, we're going to head back to Keith. You've mentioned the biological markers, which I think a lot of people are a lot more familiar with. And again, I kind of take myself as the litmus test here, not being the expert. Walk me through the process. So if an athlete is ready to return and the biological symptoms have been mitigated or have lessened and they've been cleared to go back, what would the psychological protocol be then? Because as you said, it's kind of not really addressed. But like, I think of myself when I was an athlete, and I didn't have a concussion, but mm-hmm. if I had blown out my ankle when I came back to play volleyball, you know, there was like, ooh, you know, apprehension to going up and fully jumping or fully hitting or fully digging and diving for a ball. So, and certainly no one talked to me about it, but again, I'm a little long in the tooth, so I don't think any of that stuff. And they didn't really talk about those things. Just get yourself back on the court. Yeah. So I'm just curious if there is a protocol.
I wouldn't say there is. In fact, I think the issue's been sort of underattended to in many respects. You know, I mean, to be honest, coaches want their athletes back to play, and athletes want to be back to playing a sport. So acknowledging that there are some psychological hurdles that even when you're sort of ready medically to go back is only going to slow that process down, they think. And therefore, do we really want to get into that? But my guess is that those issues hinder recovery anyways. It's going to be hard for somebody to go back to any sport if they're concerned about getting injured again, if they're concerned about long-term consequences, and really commit to playing the sport. We don't have good data on that. It is tricky, but I think the best thing that coaches and athletes and loved ones and around them, other clinicians can do is simply to say, you know, it could be psychologically kind of tricky to go back to play. And I think it's about being a good clinician or a good coach is ask your athletes how they're doing. Not all of them will be straightforward, but being able to acknowledge that, you know, it takes a little psychological preparedness to go back to play and play your best. If you're carrying around psychological worry and concern, I can bet you won't perform as well. So it isn't about, oh, I just want to do touchy-feely stuff with you. You know, from a sports psychology perspective, it's about being really prepared to play your best or to perform your best and be the best member of the team you can be. And so that means like, yeah, I've got some stuff I'd like to talk about and just work through. Doesn't necessarily mean that you could take a lot longer to go back to play. If anything, it might actually make you go back to play well, better. And that's what I always tell athletes, kids, and adolescents about reporting concussion. This is about getting you back to doing the things you want to do. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee you, if you don't tell us and we find it out later because you're starting to have symptoms, it's going to take you longer. So this is actually for the benefit of not just you, but for your team and your performance.
Absolutely. So we've kind of touched on a little bit where your research has been recently, but I wanted to kind of pick your brain a bit on where the research might be headed. So looking at it from, say, two sides, both the physical or biological markers versus the psychological, are there any new technologies like wearable technology or AI or anything that's coming down the pike that you think might change how we support athletes with concussions in the future?
Well, there's a ton of work going on in biomarkers in a variety of different types of biomarkers, not just blood-based, which gets a lot of attention, or broadly the fluid biomarkers, because there's a lot of interest in whether we might use saliva in place of blood because it's easier to get. And I think what we're going to see, and my guess, is in the next 10 to 15 years, will be point of care devices that let immediately off the field get immediate assessments of those biomarkers that are really not make a decision in and of themselves, but give us better information about, you know, with that suspected concussion, is it really a concussion? Mm-hmm. Right now, what we see, right, if we're watching an NHL game or an NFL game, we see the athlete go off, something mysterious happens back there behind the curtain, and then there's a decision made. But that decision still rests very much on the skill of the person doing the assessment, the physician who does the assessment, but also what the athlete's willing to say. So, and we don't have objective biomarkers yet, but we're getting closer and closer. So I think that'll be a big advance, because we probably will use them not just to assist in diagnosis, but actually to help track recovery and predict how long recovery is going to take. So I think that'll be a big advance that we'll see here in the next few years. Another that I think we're going to see is a lot more emphasis on getting better data about what works, both to prevent and manage concussions. So clinical trials of various sorts, even though they're hard to do, they're hard to get funded, frankly, they're really where we get some of our best evidence in terms of what tends to work. And on the management side, you know, these psychological interventions are cheaper and arguably easier in some ways to implement than some medical interventions. And so we need more data to see what works there. You know, I think we're going to see that, start to see interventions at the biological level. Neuromodulation, for example, various forms of neuromodulation are really starting to come into their own in terms of their potential effectiveness, but they work best when they're paired with some other intervention. So I think we'll start to see the medication stuff that hasn't been a lot of work done on what medications might help, but most of those have failed in more severe TBI. I'm probably more like interested in neuromodulation. We begin to see more in the way of psychotherapies, but also what can we do at the sort of system or social level? What do we need to do to make rehabilitation more widely available, for example? Not everybody has access, even athletes, to appropriate sorts of care.
Absolutely. So basically, you've just talked about all this work that potentially could be coming down the pike to help with concussion care and prevention. A little bit sticky to say, but we've seen a shift in funding in the sports sector, and one of the areas that has been affected is concussion. So what do you think the impact is or will have on the sector and athlete safety?
Well, I think what happened is confluence of things that occurred where some of the safety issues that came up were no longer concussion. We had a pandemic, changed our priorities in a lot of ways. I think what we need to do is continually remind Minister of Health, CIHR, concussion hasn't gone away. It's still there. It's affecting 500,000 Canadians a year with new concussion, much less the ones who are still dealing with persisting problems as a result of concussion. Certainly, it's harder to do research when there's not enough funding. It's harder to do knowledge translation when there's not enough funding. It's harder to get it into the sport organizations when there's not enough funding. Organizations like Parachute, the Canadian Concussion Network, Brain Injury Canada, we're all trying to come together and have a consistent voice so it doesn't seem like we're competing against each other, but more trying to work as a team to try to maximize the value of the dollars that are invested, to not reinvent the wheel when we don't have to, and to find the best ways to get the research done, to get the research into clinical practice and practice in general. Probably, unfortunately, the case that when it comes to federal budgets and provincial budgets, the squeaky wheels tend to get the grease. So we need to be squeaky wheels. We need to be advocates. And frankly, those of us in academia and even in clinical practice have not always, you know, been taught or been inclined to be advocates and involved in advocacy, but we really need to do it. We need to get also parents and coaches and kids and athletes involved in advocacy as well, because, you know, if it's just us in an ivory tower or just clinicians going into the government saying, give us money, there's a natural skepticism of, well, you just want it for your own well-being. But if we have lots of people with concussion or loved ones of folks who have had concussion, coaches, trainers, physicians, other healthcare professionals advocating, we're more likely to hopefully see that, at least slow that trend, if not get more funding put into concussion and sport.
Absolutely. So if funding wasn't an issue, what is one concussion-related research project or awareness initiative that you would like to see funded to support concussion in sport?
That's a long list. Of course, I'm partial to the Canadian Concussion Network being its inaugural chair, and we need funding to sustain our efforts. But part of those efforts that I think are really important, one I'll just highlight, Canada's been a leader in a lot of ways in concussion, particularly in terms of integrating across sectors and having good crosstalk between researchers, clinicians, people with lived experience, government, industry, nonprofits. And we need to continue that. But one of the real strong places we are is in guidelines. We have some of the best adult and child guidelines for management of mild TBI or concussion anywhere in the world. Some of the sport-related ones are built on the international consensus. But those guidelines that I'm speaking of go beyond that. But the funding for those is coming to an end. And the best kind of guidelines are what we now call living guidelines, that are continually being updated rather than a guideline that's written and then 10 years later is updated when all the stuff that's happening in between doesn't get reflected. So that's just one sort of knowledge translation thing that has a mass impact as clinicians look to those guidelines for the current evidence, to suggestions about what to do, for resources they can use. And I'm pretty concerned, as are many people, that those are going to sort of come to an end, or at least not be updated regularly, because we don't have the funding to support them.
So we've talked a little bit about the clinicians and the academic side. What would you say, if you could give one key takeaway that you'd like our listeners, whether they're athletes, coaches, or sport enthusiasts, weekend warrior types, to remember about concussions in sport, what would that be?
I always start to tend to want to remind people of the huge benefit of sport. And I don't think concussion means you don't take part in sport, but you learn about it enough to recognize what puts you at risk for it, what things you can do to prevent it, wearing proper equipment, but then also learning about how to recognize it, how to tell people about it if it happens, and seek appropriate care. The worst thing you can do if you think you had a concussion is not tell anybody and just see if it gets better. That's not necessary these days, and it's actually very counterproductive. One of the things I emphasize to people is there's a lot of publicity about the downside of concussion and how people can have these persisting problems. And while we do know that maybe 25% of the folks with concussion have persisting symptoms that last, say, longer than a month, the half glass full, or maybe three quarter glass full, is that most people get better. And it's important to sort of emphasize for folks that if you've had one concussion, you're likely to get better. You don't lose the benefit of sport, which is immense. Physical benefits, mental benefits documented. We don't want folks' fear of concussion to stop them from participating in sporting activities they love, but be smart.
Absolutely. Keith, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. Your research sheds light on an injury that affects so many of our athletes. I think our listeners will definitely walk away with a much deeper understanding of the how from both a physical and mental perspective. And more importantly, everyone involved in sport, from parents to coaches to administrators, will have a clearer understanding on how to support athletes who have had a concussion so that they can help their athletes get back to sport safely. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
And to our listeners, I want to thank you for being here as we take a closer look at the hidden dynamics shaping Canadian sport. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to Sport Intelligence, The Canadian Perspective, and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments, do not hesitate to reach out to us on social media at @CIRC_Canada on Instagram or at @CIRCTweets on X. And of course, if you're interested in learning more about all things concussion, please visit our concussion portal at CIRC.ca/concussion, where you will find research summaries, myth or fact videos, infographics, and recorded presentations. And they'll feature researchers, sport leaders, and athletes like Jen Kish sharing their experiences with concussions. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.